So I'll be moderating us through this discussion today on the articles. I think you got, and thank you for that, for the participation and reading. How we're going to start is I'll first go through a summary of what the articles are, so that will ground the people that are actually listening in, and so they have some context for the conversation. Then the next thing we'll do is I'd like to start with, we always ask which article you found the most useful or the most thought-provoking or the most helpful. So Tanya will set up a poll for us on that. We'll work through that article, and then we'll also ask which one you found the least useful. And then we'll use the chat feature to be able to figure out what is the theme that we see and hopefully have a productive discussion. So I'll start with the summary. So just give me about 5 minutes to go through those. Our first article was the Agile C-Suite out of HBR. And the point there was that an Agile enterprise requires an Agile C-Suite, and that their job is different, operating an Agile system versus what an Agile team would do. Now, interestingly enough, they started off the article saying that formal Agile teams, you know, the executive team would not do that. Then they went on to point out that they did exactly that for many things. They had an Agile manifesto for their behaviors, the way they organized their work and made contributions. They had 15-minute stand-up decision-making decisions sessions daily. And then the other thing they pointed out in that article was the extreme behavioral change needed. They said that Agile teams often cite leadership and culture as the greatest barriers. And their point there was that leaders aren't fighting Agile. They simply don't know what they're supposed to do. And that the Agile environment has a way of exposing leaders that know more than they think they do, or think they know more than they do. Focus on operations and reviewing and second guessing managers versus making connections. So that was the Agile C-Suite was the title of that article. The second article was from Deloitte. And that article ran through a design process around how work might change that was tweaked to focus more on options for human-machine pairing. And it followed what seems to be pretty standard when any article or conversation is around human and machine pairing, there's three basic options there. One is artificial intelligence, which is working towards actual human intelligence, recognition and that sort of thing. Machine learning, which is predictive behavior and analytics, and then robots. So followed that convention and talked about a design process tweaked to accommodate that. Talked about leader behaviors, transformation objectives, and shared performance goals. Diverted to design thinking as well. And also had a bit of strategic analysis, looking at disruptions, emerging careers, what new data you might.
Did you all lose audio?
I lost Gina, but I was thinking it was me because at the moment she blipped, my husband sat down at his desk and kicked on his internet. So
she looks frozen.
Gina went out for me.
Don't blame my husband.
All right. Well, so we'll see if she reconnects. Anybody else feel like jumping in and giving a little share out for those who may not have read the articles yet to summarize the last couple of articles? Or I can read the descriptions off the...
Yeah, I don't mind. Tanya, I can. I
perfect, mind. Chris, because you're elbows deep in it, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so. So I may not get the as comprehensive summary as what Gina was putting out there, but I think the final two articles, the one from the Corporate Rebels around the hire, sort of taking some lessons learned from hire in China, so very much talked about the sort of ecosystem management and how you might do that on a reasonably large scale, obviously in the size of hire. I think those guys are also producing a series of articles at the moment, so it wasn't perhaps as complete as some of the other articles we had this month. It was like a small part of a much longer series of narrative that they're putting out on that piece. And then the final one was if I've not miscounted, the final one was the recorded webinar, right, from London Business School. So I only watched this afternoon, a bit of a late afternoon watch for me. But this was quite a comprehensive conversation to look at, you know, the some of the patterns and some of the themes that we've noticed over the last few weeks as people have sought to kind of stabilize their operations first and foremost, and not perhaps leak into the red zone, but then helpfully, I thought, drawing on a number of lessons learned from perhaps the financial crash 10, 12 years ago, to say what are some of those patterns sort of that are already starting to emerge, and how are people making some both strategic and operational choices to survive past survival mode, right? The crisis is the crisis, but we need to have that kind of longer term trajectory about some choices that we're now going to start to make. So I don't know. I don't know if that summarizes them all.
There was one more, the Nicolay Warren organization design implications.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
Jardina, do you want to talk about that?
I'll jump in and say the Nicolay Warren org design implications of COVID-19. And he went through and some of the, he put up a model of the experience of the user versus the solution delivered, and the idea of the design of the organization can use a model like that to integrate the two so that it doesn't become a he didn't say a polarity, but I think that was an implication. And then he talked about, there was actually an attachment. I'll just mention that he talked about reconfiguration or reconfiguring software that he and his company use as a method to help people redesign. And I'll stop with that.
All right. So I haven't seen Gina pop back on yet, so I'm sure she is scrambling to do so. But Jardina, who facilitated last month's call, said that she could kind of help guide you all through the conversation. And something that Jardina started last month for us, which kind of was expediting things a little bit, was the use of polls to kind of get people's opinions on what was your most useful article. And so I'm going to go ahead and populate that up now, and then she'll kind of work with the conversation based on some feedback we get from that. So you should see a poll pop up on your screen that lists the 5 articles. And if you could just respond for this one, which one did you find to be the most useful? I'll give it about 15 more seconds.
Cool.
Running naked. Okay, I think we've got a favorite. I'll share that with everyone. The favorite is the Agile C-Suite. And then I understand, and you recall, Jardina, you kind of talked a little bit about what led that to being people's favorite.
Yeah, did we do the theme? I forget how we did the theme last week.
You know what, Gina was going to have us do the theme in the chat box, but if you want to talk through the theme, you are welcome to do, now that you're kind of popping into this role, whichever you're more comfortable with.
Yeah, sorry about that. But I am curious about the theme, but so we'll dig into the Agile C-Suite in just a minute. Let's see if we can find a theme in the meantime. So go ahead in the chat box and enter in what you think the theme was of this month's. I'm going to put one in too.
So, and for those of you who aren't actively participating in the conversation, but did have an opinion about what you saw as a theme for the articles, absolutely feel free to type something into the chat box, and because I'm sure we'll build on that as the conversation gets going.
Yeah. And if you didn't read the articles, you're still always welcome to participate. I'm just not going to put you on the spot as much. That's the only thing that frees you from.
Let's see. Bruce, yours popped in, but it popped into me in our separate thread. So I'm going to.
So let's see what we're getting. Forms of Agile, strategic-driven redesign opportunities post-crisis, and how to coordinate the change, the role of coordination. So that came up a bit, the coordination. Rethinking requiring mindset and behavioral shifts. Building resilience from the top down. Mine was, we're bad at predicting, but we're gonna predict anyway, which is what I got from the video. Using a rapid approach. applying agility in the COVID disruption. Agility ties closely to decisions, which right now is about letting go, so less control. And I know that there's some folks on the phone here too, so if you are not able to use the chat and you want to just shout it out, go for it. Okay, so definitely some themes here around COVID, of course. I think that's been a theme for a couple of months now. And then redesigning to be more responsive, coordinating, resilience, and leadership as a role. Excellent. All right, so shall we dive into, please tell me if Gina comes back and I don't see her, because I don't see everybody. Let's see. Should we dive into the Agile C-suite and what we liked about that? I'm going to go around the horn for folks that have checked off yes in terms of participating. I don't have a lot of yeses. So let's see. Let's start with you, Lori. Lori, what did you like about that article? Maybe it wasn't your favorite, but let's see what you
thought. Am I muted? Yeah. So one of the things I liked about it was the kind of the direct hit on the challenges that leaders have when they're trying to lead transformations. One of the things that I think we've all probably seen is they want to do agile and they don't know how to be agile. And I know we've struggled with it over the years. How do we help them be agile if we can't get them to hold still long enough for us to help them understand what that is? So I love that there's something in Harvard Business Review that I know a lot of those folks read, and that they will see that maybe they don't know how to be agile and they can reach out for help and attract that. And then from a purely practical point of view, I liked a lot the table with the sliding scales. I'm trying to find it in my magazine to show you guys, but so the balancing part of it, I thought that was really helpful and kind of like a thumbnail. So yeah. Those were my two favorite things.
Cool, thank you. Gina, I see you're back.
I am what I miss. I'm so sorry. I've never had my internet go down ever in the 4 years I've lived here, and it's gone. I'm back on, but I'm on the mobile hotspot on my phone. So I sincerely apologize. What great timing, right?
That is, of course, right? So we put our themes into the chat window and kind of just ran through those. And now we're just talking about the favorite article turned out to be the Agile C-Suite. So we're just going around the horn talking about why we liked it. And we started with Lori, and that's as far as we got.
Okay, let's keep going with that then, if we did that poll, and I'll look at the themes while we're talking about that. Cool. And I've got to get my participant window back up here. So, okay, fantastic. Thank you. Thanks, everybody. So we started with Lori. So let's go to Arnold.
Sorry about that. I was muted. I think, the two things that I probably took away the most from it was the fact that the C-suite often sees themselves above, the fray when we deal with, particularly, developing Agile. It's always for the teams. It's for the, it's more for the operational aspect, but not the role of the people who are, at that C-suite level, the CEOs, the CIOs. So I thought that, putting that as the center of the focus of the article was, quite meaningful, as well as the tools that they talked about in terms of developing the manifesto. And I think that, both the theoretical as well as the practical aspects, I thought, made it for a pretty rich article.
That was my impression as well. I like that it really hit hard on the behavior, because you don't see very many articles that talk about the leadership behavior. You just don't. It'll be very abstract around, leaders need to change their behavior. But this one talked about how very painful it was. And the different things they had to do. So I completely agree with you on that one. That was my impression also. Chris, would you like to add on? Even if it wasn't your favorite article?
It was one of my favorites. I broke the rules this month. I didn't have a favorite. So I like the examples, and not to add on to everybody else, I'm just thinking about some different points I've got. Was the one thing that stood out for me was it started to talk a lot about the sort of coordination mechanisms so we can have this coherence of effort across the organization. So I thought that was quite simple in the way that they put it across, which was helpful to look at. If we had all of these, I guess, first and foremost, you know, what are some of our strategic priorities? How do we articulate that out to teams? But then how do we make sure that the coordinated effort across the piece, and it, just the simplicity of the kind of 15-minute roll-on windows in the morning, I thought was excellent. You go, that's sort of, you know, from top to bottom decision-making, that was quite clever. I had a negative part of the article, but that's not part of this, is it? Because it was our favorite, article.
No, let's hear the negative, because it's not everybody's favorite article, and people react to different things. I'm very interested to get to talking about the Deloitte article. Go ahead. What did you find as a negative?
So the article, it's something that I'm exploring at the moment in my work, actually, around balance. So at the beginning of the article, the first sort of 10% of the article, I was really enjoying, because it spoke about how not the whole organization needs to be agile. But then it went on to, you know, the rest of the article did indeed speak about agile. And I thought it missed this opportunity to talk about, well, what happens when the agile part of your organization butts up against the non-agile part of the organization, such as funding or finance or, you know, some of those typically highly scaled capabilities in an organization. So I was hoping, as they referenced this neat thumbnail at the beginning about balance, talk to me more about the balance, but it didn't. It still sort of really drove home the messages about the application of agile rather than how you keep the organization in sync.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The funding part I can add on from other research is quite a bear. I found some organizations that have taken literally 7 years to change their funding model, and where they've had success has been, and you're right, I think it would be interesting to see more literature about this, where they've had success is they simply, like that Hire article where they talked about getting solution owners. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is getting the different features and backlogs and, you know, things they're working on, and then literally forcing a priority discussion. It doesn't fundamentally change the funding model. It's a lot of overhead, but those are the two things I've seen come up around that. Bruce, what would you add on the Agile article?
Yeah, it was not my favorite. There are two high points for me. One was just that list of the dimensions. They had about 8 or 9 dimensions. It sort of looked like the STAR model with a few more added on. And then they said, you know, in one extreme it's chaotic, and the other extreme it's, what was the word? Anyway, it was very rigid versus very chaotic, and then seeking a balance. And what I thought was useful about that is for either us, if we're consulting to those leaders or to the leaders themselves, just a list of, oh, here's some particulars you can pay attention to. And the balance doesn't have to be just do good on this. It's maybe in our organization, it needs to be shifted a little more toward the moving fast, or a little more toward the holding our ground. So I liked that list. The other thing I liked about it was just the idea that you know, the top leadership ought to do it. They ought to get into Agile, and that it is different than a, you know, as they put it, a standard team. What I didn't like is, first of all, that same list that I just said I liked. I looked at the list and I said, who wouldn't just pick those middle dimensions? It's, of course, everybody wants that. And that, for me, made it a bit of a turnoff as something I might want to use with a, you know, a top leadership team, my being afraid that they would just say, of course. And I also felt like it did slightly oversimplify the ideas of what a regular standard Agile team does. In my experience, they're usually a lot richer than the way they were portrayed here.
Mm-hmm. Interesting points. And what were the points you were talking about that specifically around you thought anybody would do this? What were those?
Well, let's see. The first one in the list was inspiring, my handwriting here, inspiring shared ambitions. That was the balanced view. And then on the static side, if it's too static, it's soulless. And if it's, I didn't write down what, on the chaotic side, it would be vague and fickle goals. So So and they were, the point was that it's a balancing act and that not every organization needs to have the same balance.
Right. Okay, thanks for clarifying that. I'm sure that's helpful to people. Let's see, a few more on this. Diane, did you want to comment on that article?
Unfortunately, I did not get through the whole article, so I'm going to pass, but I'm learning a lot from the rest of you guys.
Okay, great. Jardina, did you comment while I was off, or would you like to add in?
I did not. I would love to comment. Yeah, I mean, to Bruce's point just now, I love the concept of them using polarities and tensions, but kind of to your last point, the fact that you have two terrible things at each end, it would be nice if instead of soulless targets and vague and fickle goals, I can have quantitative metrics and qualitative metrics or something that maybe I can identify with. But, so it's not sort of like, let me not choose between these two terrible things and do something awesome in the middle, right? Because the polarities really are both important and good. But so the article overall for me as an Agilist, I didn't love the tone of the article, like you Agile people don't know what you're talking about, let me tell you. But there were some, like Lori said, it's nice to have something in Harvard Business Review that's promoting what we've been doing for years. And I did love this one sentence I wanted to just read to you. Executives come to understand that an hour spent reviewing or second guessing the work of experienced operating managers creates far less value than an hour invested in developing cross-functional innovations. So to me, that's about stop directing work and start creating conditions for success, right? And executives, I mean, this is a journey for them. Like I've been training and teaching this, coaching executives through this for years, but that is a hard thing to stop directing work. So I love that was in here. That was a key point.
I highlighted that one as well. And then the other one I highlighted was executives tend to think they know more than they think they do. And I thought I was really impressed to have that called out in HBR because that is inevitably the case. Interesting to be supervising work and still have that perspective. Jill, I think you're the other participant. And then I'm going to ask if there was anyone else who wanted to add on around the call. Is there anything you'd like to add?
One of the things I liked the most were just the reinforcement of the behaviors that need to change for the leaders. I liked how they said they had to change to asking how can we instead of focusing on how it can be done. When decisions need to be made that would impact multiple groups, they didn't sit in a room by themselves and do it. They called it swarming, getting everybody together that was involved. And they went from meetings to kind of working sessions. So they really realized they took a lot of the bureaucracy out. They mentioned not asking the employees to just put together these PowerPoints anymore, which I know can just take up so much time, and present it in a way that just makes sense on how they've already got it put together. So I really, really appreciated reinforcing that, because that was a key theme I saw across all the articles, that changing behavior, leaders needing to be humble and going from commanding to really coaching. I liked some of the stats they had in there as well, because I'm coaching a team specifically on being more strategic. They said by the end of the transition, the leaders quadrupled the time they were able to spend on strategy. So I think that's going to be a big kind of ROI to say, why would you want to let go of the control that, a lot of the executives tend to have? What would be the payoff?
Yeah. Okay. That was my reaction as well, as I think I said before I got booted off. Really, zeroing in on the leader behavior, and it doesn't seem to be frequent out there. Is there anyone else I didn't call on, because I'm watching your participation, that wants to comment on that article? Or questions from any observers, listeners? Okay. Then I want to go back to, before I got booted off, I want to ask a question. We haven't had to do this before because, again, I've had internet solid standing for 4 years up until now. Were the summaries useful? Because I had just gotten to the third summary. Would it be useful to go back to that for the listeners? Should I pick up where I got kicked out on the webinar, or do you want to just keep going?
Chris jumped in and gave two of the articles summaries, and Bruce did a third. So we okay. Covered for you.
Got that covered. Okay, great then. Okay, then next thing is let's go to what we found least useful, and then we'll go to themes.
Mm.
relaunched another poll. So it looks like some of you are.
Yeah. Well, they can see that poll.
Yep. And I might have never stopped sharing the other feedback for that one. So if I did, sorry about that.
No, it went down. It worked. Yeah.
All right. A little closer on this one, but we've got results for.
Okay, let's start. How to redesign government work for the future. So that's a tie. And then why HIRE introduced ecosystems and how they work. And then, okay, our winner is the organization design implications of COVID-19. Okay, let's start with our winner, and then definitely want to talk about the other two and where we could improve and what we'd like to see. So I'm going to start, I'll go back down the list in the other order that I have here. Jill, would you like to start a comment on our other article? Or least favorite? Or if you want to actually talk about any article that you found not favorable, even if you didn't vote for that one.
Okay, well, yeah, I did. The why HIRE introduced ecosystems and how they work. I mean, it was somewhat interesting. I just thought it was so targeted, specific to an industry. I didn't get as much out of it that could apply to multiple organizations compared to others. It's interesting. It just felt like it could be really difficult to implement and didn't apply to a lot.
And what did you think would be difficult to implement?
Just having these, you know, all these small, they call them what, microeconomic systems and small entrepreneurial systems all reaching out to each other, disbanding and banding. And I don't think, it's just not as common today. So I guess that's where I was struggling going, that's interesting. Not applying to anyone I'm working with right now from maybe far, far into the future.
According to the literature, HIRE is quite far ahead on that. So I think one interesting part of that, it wasn't my least favorite, but not my favorite either, was, and I draw people's attention to this if you hadn't read it, is the use of contracts. Because so what they found, there were two things in that article that if you didn't call it out already, and I apologize if you did. One was that they had to connect with the experience owner. So I'm seeing that in my work. That's the only way we're able, we can't get to full agility. So this experience owner connection is working. So they had, I think, a solutions owner and one other one. I can't get my note back up because I haven't connected all my devices. But so they had that. So that was one thing. And then the other thing was the use of contracts. And if that could work internally. So that might be something to explore further with that article. But as you said, Jill, they're pretty far out there on the micro enterprises and the team of teams and network and all that. So it wouldn't apply to a lot of organizations, but might be interesting concepts. Lori, what would you add?
I liked the concept of the ecosystem approach. I thought that was helpful across a lot of organizations. What I didn't like about it was that it was, it seemed to be really specific to HIRE's practices without a lot of extrapolation to how anything like that might work anywhere else. So it was almost like it started to feel like an internally written PR piece about how great they were. And I kind of lost interest once that connection happened for me. It was like, I'm kind of done.
That makes sense. Corporate Rebels, that site, has been following HIRE for a while. So that's probably why you've got that fan feeling. And so, and if anybody was interested in, you know, there's five or six other articles out there around HIRE and how they've been following them. Because we've had it come up before in this forum where we've read about HIRE and micro enterprises. Arnold? Do you have anything to add around the HIRE article?
I mean, I thought that, you know, it I didn't rate it as one of my least favorite. I just thought that I thought it was touching on some interesting concepts, but I don't think it just didn't seem to go into it in enough detail to really get anything out of it. I think that was part of my concern with it. I mean, conceptually, you come away understanding, you know, what the whole, you know, notion around, you know, ecosystems was and that type of thing. You know, the diagram I thought was interesting, particularly around, you know, experience. You know, the firm that I'm with, you know, is obsessed with, you know, customer and client experience, and I'm always trying to move it move the dial from a conversation of experience in terms of organizational experience versus physical experience, partially because I'm part of an architectural firm and they can't get out of their own way when it comes to physicality versus organizational. But I thought that, so I would have hoped that there would have been a little bit more substance to it behind it.
What are you finding before we move on around this experience connection? Because that's really what that article was about. It was about the experience connect, you know, just that's how they're connecting the lack of connections in their micro enterprises was experience. Do you have anything else to add there, observations or other things we could look at around using experience as that connection?
Well, I think, you know, what I found, you know, sort of working on sort of both sides of the aisle, you know, in terms of conversations around experience, is that there's a lack of definition often around what experience means. You know, you go to an HR conference, you know, and the conversation around experience is one thing. You know, you go to a DXD or a digital experience conference, and their whole notion around experience is very different. And it's almost fascinating when you sort of take a step back and you begin to look at how, you know, different, you know, categories of professions that all deal with people are defining experience and using experience somewhat differently within their own silos, which I find fascinating.
I agree with you, and the observation I'd add to that is I think it's the different design perspectives, you know, user experience design, service experience design, graphics design, voice design, you know, and you know, there's some element of design with all these different things, but when you bring these design professionals together, that's where I think you really see the very different emphasis and experience, just an aside on that one. So I didn't mean to take us off, but I thought that was an interesting right. that, you know, around that experience connection.
And each one thinks they own it, though. Which is interesting.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Each one thinks they own exactly. You know, the realm of experience. So
yeah, that's my observation about where the experience definition tends to fall apart. Diane, your least favorite article, was it among the three winners, or talk about anything you found least useful and why?
Yeah, I only got through the last three, so I just admit that of those three, it's not really a fair comparison. The video leading through a pandemic was probably my least favorite. Somebody else said it before, because it's a lot about thinking that we can predict what's happening next and trying to come up with your scenarios to respond to the crisis, and it feels like the environment, it's still so unknown. So, but there was some nuggets in there about communication and how we try to massage the message, and just sometimes it's like it has to be very direct and clear, bold, realistic, honest, so forth. So there were some nuggets in there, but of the three that I did get through, the video was my least favorite.
Okay. On the video, I would not have sat through it if I wasn't moderating the call. So I made it till 6 minutes to the end. And there was one thing that I don't know if everybody caught it, but I want to call it out because I thought it was just useful to know. I think we've all seen that, and it kind of digressed off the topic of the webinar, but it was around habit. And I think we've all read it takes 3 weeks to form a habit. And he mentioned research that said actually the average is 66 days because, you know, some things take 84 days. So then between, you know, like 20 days, and he mentioned, you know, taking drinking more water, you can do that 20 days. But if you're going to do sit-ups every day, that'll take you 84 days to make that happen. So I thought that was interesting. And that was the nugget in the webinar that was useful to go through. So if everybody didn't catch that, I wanted to call that out just because it was a little bit out of our realm, but I think still good to know as far as people driving change, you know, the more painful it is, the 80 day figure is good to know. Bruce, do you want to add on around your least useful, or if they were in the top three, or anything?
I'm not too bought into dissing the article. So what I'm going to do is pick the two that I liked least and tell you what I liked about them. Org design implications of COVID. I did appreciate that they did put up that graph that. Attempt to integrate the user experience with the solution. And I find that's often a bugaboo of mine in the design world, where we talk about user experience. And I feel like too often we forget, wait a minute, there are actually nuts and bolts and money and, you know, all these other things in there that we have to have a really good solution is not that simple, but you know, that those two dimensions, I think, are good to be integrated. On the other one that I put as liking least was the higher article. And what I didn't like is the oversimplification. But one of the things I did like is the specific concrete example of what an ecosystem looks like. In the refrigerator example, where they said that, you know, when you look at what surrounds a refrigerator and the use of a refrigerator, well, you buy, store, and prepare food. And so it opens up possibilities of the company looking at the ecosystem as delivery of food, recipes about food. There's another one I didn't write down clearly, but I liked the concrete example. And I myself use, as one of my big three, I call it either larger systems thinking or macro systems thinking. And I really liked their title of ecosystems thinking. And I just grabbed onto that. And then I tend to often forget to make it more concrete like they did with their examples. So those are my two least favorites.
Thank you. And I think I thought about that, as you said, I thought we should probably find language. I mean, we're trying to improve. And so that's why we asked the question, but we can work on some language around least useful, least favorite or something, but there always is a nugget there. I thought the same exact thing with the, some of the things that you've mentioned. I agree. Andrew, can you comment on the article you think could need improvement? We'll start the two or three articles you thought could improve and why.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Sorry I joined late. I didn't read the higher article, so apologies there. But I'll just go in order very quickly. So the Agile C-Suite, the thing they could improve is just not use the word Agile. Because I do feel like using the word Agile, it takes away my enjoyment of many things. And it felt to me what they were saying was this team took strict prioritization and cooperative teams and made their company work better. But they labeled it Agile. And I do understand why they did that. But there was a lot of stretch there. And it did feel like they'd thrown in Agile to make it sound cool. So they could do that improvement. The how to redesign government work for the future, actually thought was, I was really put off at the start there because it was just a smorgasbord of examples of technology being applied to work. And I didn't really see what the narrative was. And I know they introduced it at the start. So I'd like to have seen it more, the whole thing kind of weaved into the examples. Okay, well, what's the big picture? What are the effects of work? Are really linked much more to the effect on people's way of working. Leading through a pandemic. Actually, you know what? Did I do that one? I don't think I did either. And the organization design implications. I liked the thinking of, okay, we have to think about this, thinking, in terms of the short term, medium term, and who knows what the long term will bring. Here's some things we could think about. I'd like to have seen more specificity, but it's more of a blog, so I guess that's the way it is.
Okay, thank you. Chris, do you want to add on where you thought there was some opportunity, the articles you thought there was some opportunity?
I think really just to draw out something that many people have mentioned is around completeness. You know, we had a blog that was maybe a 3-minute read and a Deloitte article that was a 4.5-hour read. That's not to say that there wasn't stuff in there that wasn't useful, but the higher example for me was lacking that kind of completeness view. And perhaps to Bruce's point, it was oversimplifying what they've done. But then again, if you look at the comments on that article, I found there was more richness in the comments, the questions and answers that people put underneath the blog than what was in the blog itself. So there's clearly, I think, lots we can learn from that sort of ecosystem design. So it's just around completeness. I think the one thing that stretching the answer and question a little bit that I'm observing is There's a number of things, if you like, as a theme to some of these articles that looks at sort of medium and long-term design. But I have a fear that a lot of the companies that I'm observing, particularly in the UK at the moment, are faced with the real probability of restructuring and making lots of redundancies in the next sort of 3 months. And they're going to do that badly. So there is this leap for me between what's perhaps some immature organizations that are in a very reactive mode or about to do in the next 3 months versus perhaps some of the themes that we're exploring as a community in our articles. So there feels to me a bit of a gap between the reality of some of those immature organizations versus some of the things that we're observing in the art of the possible.
Yeah, that was the second point in that that Design COVID article. I want to add on that Deloitte article, because you mentioned it being a novel. That was my least favorite because I thought it was sorely in need of an edit. It looked like four people had just put in anything they wanted to say and it hadn't been tied together. And something else with that article that I think is an interesting point, and I couldn't find this reference. Last August at the ODC conference, which was in Boston at Harvard, Scott Stern is from MIT. He presented a paper, and he apparently didn't publish it. It was a presentation, but they divided patents into three categories, the three machine learning categories, artificial intelligence, machine learning, which is predictive analytics, and robotics. And among these patents, over some period of time, I think 10 years, only machine learning has taken off like a rocket. Otherwise, AI and robotics were a very distant second and third, and it's been reported in multiple places that Google has put a lot of effort into this, and they still can't get to even what a two-year-old child can do as far as, you know, identifying different objects. So it was interesting that Deloitte article that so much effort was in, put towards that human-machine learning interface when all they need to pay attention to is ML because these other areas aren't coming along as quickly. I mean, there are robots stocking shelves and, you know, there is artificial intelligence that can, you know, prompt you and guide you, but it's really not at the level where we probably would completely design an organization around it. Analytics is at that level. So that was why that was my least favorite, because I thought it should have, focused more on what we have at hand and what we can actually do at this point. So I just wanted to add that in. And Scott Stern, if you don't follow him at MIT, does a lot of work in that area. So he didn't publish apparently that particular paper, but he does good work around these type of things. Diane, do you want to comment on what you found was least useful or least helpful? Push back on?
For an article or?
Yeah, if one of the three was your top one, but otherwise, if you didn't like the favorite, that's okay too.
Actually, the least favorite from the group was my favorite. So go figure that. The COVID, so I'll just comment on that. The COVID-19, you know, it was light, but what I really liked about it is sometimes I read these things and it's like, it's so practical. So like the whole point around coordination load, maybe because it's so here and now I'm feeling it. And I even read his little side point on why Zoom meetings are so exhausting. I just found that to be so practical for where we are right now. The point that the more people you coordinate with, the less time you have to do work. So you got to make that really efficient. And I just feel like I'm living that right now. So it kind of hit home. The other thing I liked about that article, someone mentioned just short-term, medium-term, long-term considerations. I thought that was a good way to think about things. So it's kind of funny that the least favorite was my favorite just because it was practical for me and it just hit home for kind of what I feel like I'm experiencing right now with the shift to so much virtual work. So a few thoughts just to throw out there on the other end, you know, I really like that article because of that.
Well, that's, like Bruce said, there's always nuggets, and only rarely in these conversations, and I'm in almost every one of them, do I find that that there's something where it's just completely not helpful. And another nugget in there that I'll call out that I thought was helpful is I think we tend to think about progress as just this constant forward march. And he had an example, if anyone didn't read it, around hospitals, because he lives in Norway. And he said, so they've got this design for a hospital that's this fantastic tower with this well-designed flow. And he said the hospital they're replacing is probably more fit for purpose for, you know, contagious diseases because it's three-story buildings far apart. And so I thought it was good to point that out. And you know, maybe we don't necessarily need to throw everything out the window and think that we're constantly going forward. So I'll add that on to your list of things, in the short, medium, and long term, and things to look at that I thought was another nugget in there. I think we're missing, I think the last around is Jardina, but I will double check. Jardina, can you add on around what you thought you'd push back on or could use improvement?
I would love to. And I love, Bruce, you know, you saying that you don't like to diss things. So I like to just reframe it as, you know, what's controversial or what's provocative. Because some of the stuff, so I didn't like my article, I should say, or I fell into the trap. The organizational design implications of COVID-19 was the one I found the most controversial. But this stuff that's in there, I've read it in other places too. So I don't blame this article. I think it's worth a discussion. A couple of things. So kind of contrary to what you just said, Diane, reducing coordination. So I get it. I mean, I have the Zoom fatigue too, totally understand. But I feel like it's undoing stuff we've been doing for so many years to get more people to coordinate. I mean, to get less dependency, yes, in your work, sure. Yes, we want to break dependencies. But to have people communicate with less other people, that's breaking all the stuff we've been striving for. And that just kind of scares me. And then the last thing was, in the long term, he talks about building resilience, which I'm all for the word building resilience. But the way he talks about it is basically lean has broken all of our ability to have buffer, right? That's what they're blaming. And not just in this article, this is everywhere. Cuomo's even talking about this. I don't know that saying because we didn't have buffer, we weren't able to sustain is the answer to becoming more adaptable and responsive. Like, let's look at, so the supply chain, right? Just in time inventory means we don't have inventory. But could we make that supply chain more adaptable without actually adding buffer? Like, there's other things to explore there, I think, besides just adding a ton of buffer back in and say, screw lean, screw just in time. We're just gonna have tons of buffers for every possible thing we could possibly ever need. So that's why I thought that one was kind of controversial.
The interesting point there is around what you said around resilience, because that came out in the webinar as well. So he didn't say it in the COVID article. He didn't point this out. He said, you know, organizational resilience, but it was pointed out in the webinar. He said, no one's actually said what this resilience is. You know, so he did have a kind of a checklist there, and it wasn't, practical kind of things. But again, you know, and this was the theme of the last call, it was stuff that you should be doing anyway, you know, what you would cut and how you would cut it and, you know, prioritization and things like that. So that's that resilience point is interesting. Maybe we'll be seeing more about that as we go forward. Is there anyone that wanted to comment that I haven't called on or add more?
I'll add more.
Go right ahead.
Curious about that last bit of the controversy as well, and the lean, and you know, the whole thing about lean. So there has been research, I think, going back 25 years that suggests, you know, that manufacturing companies that were not lean but kind of old school did fare better in a recession, which is kind of interesting. But there was no causality or reasons in the research. It just said, hey, we looked at output, which was quality and quantity, right? But what I do find interesting about lean and the resilience part is in the US, one of the companies that has had a great COVID has been Walmart. Walmart are really known for their supply chain and leanness, right? They don't have buffers other than that they need. They really do stock the minimum inventory. But they have been really flexible about how they have upped their game. So they used to have, I think, 100 stores that would do online online ordering and in-person pickup, BOPIS, right? And I think they increased that to 2,000 or something like that within 4 weeks of COVID starting. So despite the fact that they are, you know, lauded for their supply chain efficiency, they have shown real resilience and are selling more than ever, right? So there's that part. And I think to Jardina's point, it's not about buffers, it's about flexibility. So why have we got so little toilet paper in the grocery stores and supermarkets? Probably because people aren't going to the office, and there's a completely separate supply chain for office toilet paper to home toilet paper, and they can't change that supply system up. And it's the whole way through, right? From different grades of paper through to different supply chains. And so it's having that flexibility of manufacturing to right throughout the supply chain. Adding buffer will buy you another week or another 2 weeks, but it won't buy you resilience or sustainability.
I wanted to go on that point of resilience for a minute because I and come back around to the group on that because I think it's very interesting. I want to add on absolutely shout out to Walmart. We're here living among Walmart and they seem to be doing a fine job everywhere. And then the other thing is I have a contact at Kimberly-Clark, which is one of the largest toilet paper manufacturers. And so I was talking to her about what the challenges are. So I think there's one that everybody didn't see, which is if you wanted to buy it, you should go to gyms and places that are shut down. They probably would have sold it to you. You know, the mechanism to buy it wasn't there, right? So that was one thing, not just the supply chain, but also just people, you know, consumers and you know, just thinking and being innovative. And the thing that I found out from the contact was toilet paper hasn't changed substantially in however many decades. And so they really aren't that innovative. They have a pretty slow system to pilot things and it's done in the mills. You know, they don't really have that agile test and learn type thing. And so she said that's been their challenge is getting people to really think. And even with leadership permission, they still aren't getting out of their ruts. So that was kind of an interesting take on what you just said around resilience. It's not just that flexibility, it's that maybe capacity or orientation to innovate that might be a component as well that people should be thinking about all the time, you know, because you just don't know what's going to happen. What else can people add on the concept of resilience? I think that's an interesting way to come to the end here.
Gina, there's a it's a similar point. I wanted to make sure I threw it in there. And I was looking for threads that wove these different articles together. And one of the threads that I found started, or I'll say the base of it, was in the pandemic article, where there are two games, survival and rebirth. And I thought the integration of those, for me, happened if you add the idea of what is the survival that's going to get us into something better, as opposed to how can we recreate the old, and I came up with the word synergy. I didn't see it in there, but it seemed like there was a synergy going on that if we can begin to create the new, sort of based on agile type principles like stakeholder value and that sort of thing, and then do our survival in those terms so that we don't forget the survival issues, which I often do. I'll admit that in private here. But sometimes I forget these down to earth. We got to make money. We got to have a job. We have to stay away from the COVID virus. But to do those in terms of, you know, where we might go into the future, like the ecosystems, and so forth. I found that as a thread, and I really was curious whether others found threads either in two or three articles or in across them.
Let's definitely. We do look for themes. I looked in the chat and I didn't see it, so maybe I just didn't get it because I was booted off. But let's go there. Diane, do you have a theme?
Mine was no surprise coordination.
No surprise coordination. Yeah, so that's kind of a systemic thing too, building on what Bruce said. What about you, Lori? You're on mute, Lori.
So did you ask about a theme across articles?
Yeah, if you saw a connection across the articles.
I did. I saw definitely kind of the concept of coordination and I appreciated the theme of leadership and leadership's role in coordination.
Okay, I'm following along with you too. I came out of it with, I don't know if anybody knows the American Boy Scouts, but it was always be prepared. You know, that was kind of the theme I was coming out of it with. And I especially liked in the webinar when the guy, his first principle was cash is king, which is, you know, of course, one way to be prepared. Chris, what would you add on to that?
So I think a theme that has come to me throughout this call, rather than before reading the articles prompted by Andrew, is particularly in the context of ecosystems, whether we're viewing it from me or we. So, you know, the sort of higher example is good, but it talks very much about higher as a sustainable business. I'm working in a lot in the public sector in the UK right now. And actually, one of the things that came to me from the webinar was just the simple thing about cash flow, but not just cash flow for one independent organization, across the entire sort of value chain, to say, if you're a big player in that value chain, then, you know, front that up and push some advance payments and cash towards the smaller suppliers in your value chain, because then we're all better off, rather than you just thinking about your own survival. So that's the theme that's come up for me in this call, which is, when we talk about ecosystems and resilience, can we talk about how we help one another survive rather than just ourselves?
That's a really good point. That was a problem with the whole financial system, was liquidity and capital requirements and that sort of thing. Arnold, what would you add around themes?
I mean, it's all about, you know, permeability to a certain degree, you know, whether you term it agility or resilience, like the COVID article was talking about. I mean, there were really all different forms of permeability and adaptability.
Great, thank you. Jill, I don't think we heard from you on themes, and then I think that's everybody.
Yeah, for me, what really stuck out was the importance of mindset and the psychology around it. As I think about resilience, because it starts with the leader to really get over, you know, their fear and be able to look forward, see a positive future, starting first and then helping others with that. I think right now that the companies that are being more emotionally intelligent and leading through that are going to be more resilient. So that's what I heard in every one of these articles too, the behaviors that need to change.
Yeah, behaviors around being resilient. Okay, that was a very good conversation. So I'm going to give the last minute to Tanya for anything administrative. And then one more time, my sincere apologies for those of you joining us the first time. Typically, everything's more buttoned up. I have absolutely no idea what went wrong, and I will go try to figure that out next. And I certainly hope you'll join us again. Tanya, anything else to add?
Nope. Just if people saw, we sent out an announcement about our virtual series, the transition from our content from our conference that was in April that we had to cancel. And now we're making it a series of virtual. And four of our presenters are on the call today. So Bruce, Jardina, Arnold, and Andrew are all going to be doing a peer workshop with different content. So this is a little sense of what the time together will end up being like. And as I say, the genius that these rooms connect. So go to the website and take a look at that if you're interested. We're going to probably slow down a little bit on the community conversations while we have the virtual conference next month. And we are not going to hold a June global conversation because it would fall the day after our week series. And we figure your brains are going to be full. So to throw articles in front of you and have you try to talk about them the day after the conference probably isn't the best plan. So they have decided this month's read is going to be book recommendations. So that'll be it. There will still be an issue coming out, but it won't be a series of just shorter read articles. It'll be a couple of book recommendations. Part of that is that European ODF is starting a book club. And so if you have any interest in participating in conversations around various books, Chris might be able to kind of point us in the direction of where you find out about getting involved in those calls, because that is EODF managed piece of it.
Yeah, something that Paul Tolchinsky and Thomas Doering is leading on. So it's our first one in June. Fractal Organizations is the book. Kind of have a read, bring along your review, and similar to this, but let's have some kind of stimulating debate around a specific book. And we'll see. If nobody turns up, we know that's the first and last. But if we're oversubscribed, then we'll carry on.
Just quickly, is the Fractal Organizations the one by the community acupuncture people? Or is it a larger?
I think it's Patrick, forget his surname, as English guy. I think.
Okay, all right, so that's a larger. Okay, very, very interesting then. It's okay, good to know, thanks. Anything else, Tanya?
That's it, so we'll let everybody know when the recording is available and the chat download if anybody wants to follow up on it. And Jardina, I could see you going, ooh, books, and to think about getting through a book a month on top of articles, on top of work and family. You guys are amazing.
Thank you so much. Thanks again for your patience. Have a good rest of your day. Bye.
Take care, everyone.